You're tuned to WFHB.
Volunteer powered.
Listener supported.
Community radio for South Central Indiana.
Welcome to WFHB's Daily Local News.
Written and produced entirely by volunteers from the Bloomington community and supported by the generosity of listeners like you.
Good afternoon. From the studios of Community Radio 91.3 FM, reporting live for WFHB, this is Don Guerra.
And I'm Todd Wicks. This is the Daily Local News for Tuesday, February 19th, 2019.
I'm upset that the bias is here, that it's completely okay, and that the school board and other people have done nothing to dissuade it.
Ellettsville community members spoke out during last night's Richland Bean Blossom School Board meeting. Later in the program, WFHB Assistant News Director Sarah Vaughn brings us today's feature report about Superintendent Jerry Sanders' letter to area churches asking them to pray for him and the school district.
Also coming up in the next half hour, Scott Ferris tells the story of his family's settlement in Bloomington in this week's edition of the Bicentennial Journal. We'll hear the story of one of the first families to settle in Monroe County. That's coming up in this week's edition of the Bicentennial Journal, looking back on 200 years of history in South Central Indiana. But first, your daily headlines.
The federal government shutdown ended in January. As WFHB correspondent Jake Jacobson reports, the shutdown over the federal budget impeded the availability for food assistance to over 500,000 Hoosiers. Now, area service providers, including Hoosier Hills Food Bank, are stocking up in order to cover the so-called SNAP gap.
SNAP benefits, or the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, allows individuals and families in poverty to purchase food. In Indiana, over 500,000 residents rely on SNAP benefits every month. That's almost 8% of the state's population. When the federal government shut down in January, SNAP benefits, which are distributed to states through federal funding by the USDA, began to dry up. As a result, the state agency which handles SNAP benefits, the FSSA, or the Families and Social Services Administration, issued this month's benefits early in an effort to mitigate the effects of the longest government shutdown in U.S. history. Hoosiers were encouraged to ration their benefits, as the FSSA couldn't be certain when, or if, the federal government shutdown would further cut into SNAP benefits. With February benefits issued early and March's benefits being issued in two payments next month, area food pantries are stocking up in order to address this so-called SNAP gap. Julio Alonso is the director of Hoosier Hills Food Bank in Bloomington.
Because of the government shutdown, there was a glitch in the distribution of those benefits for February. The February benefits were released early and in anticipation of the shutdown. And then once the government got up and running again and it was determined that there was a final solution to the budget issues, funding for the rest of the year was approved. But because that initial payment went out early, there was a fear that clients who are already, you know, struggling to manage their budgets and get the food that they need would have exhausted those benefits early. So now the state of Indiana with the March benefits is splitting those distributions to help alleviate that somewhat. So once again, part of that March distribution for SNAP recipients will come in late February. And then the other half of it will come on its normal schedule in March. So while we were initially anticipating that there might be a quote-unquote SNAP gap where people have exhausted their benefits and need to access food pantries in February, it now looks like if that happens, it's more likely going to be sometime in March.
Hoosier Hills Food Bank services six counties in South Central Indiana. The food bank will spend $22,000 to purchase supplemental food this month. Alonzo says roughly half of that comes from grants from United Way of Monroe County and Feeding America. Alonzo says the SNAP gap poses unique challenges for both agencies providing food and SNAP beneficiaries.
It's an issue for both, but it's definitely more of an impact on those individuals and families who are receiving SNAP benefits. They're the ones who've had that benefit schedule disrupted. What it may do for agencies like food pantries is trigger an increase in clients when those clients have actually exhausted their benefits early or something like that. But the more imperative and immediate impact is definitely going to be on the clients. But we also think there may be an impact later down the road for agencies who would see more clients coming in.
In 2017, the nonprofit food bank served over 4 million pounds of food. Since opening in 1982, Hoosier Hills has distributed over 60 million pounds of food. Alonzo says that the disruption of SNAP benefits affects local area food providers and nonprofits like Hoosier Hills Food Bank.
Well, this has definitely been the longest shutdown in history. They're always disruptive, but in the past, they've generally managed to get them resolved in a relatively short period of time. This time around, you know, there were federal workers that went a good two or maybe more cycles without paychecks. So that had a big impact on people. And the fact that it went on for so long and there was so much uncertainty about when funding would resume, I think caused a lot more anxiety and a lot more problems than past shutdowns have. This was definitely a disruption that we didn't need in the food assistance network, and that's unfortunate. But it's also an opportunity to remind folks that this is an ongoing issue, food insecurity in our community. It's something that a lot of agencies are working at on a regular basis. And because most of them do a pretty good job, it kind of gets a little bit out of sight, out of mind at some points. And I think this is a reminder that there are many people out there depending both on these federal programs like SNAP and on private sector agencies in the nonprofit community in order to have enough food to eat. And that's something we need to keep in mind, and we need to try and support those agencies.
The federal government shutdown lasted a record 35 days beginning in December of 2018. SNAP benefits are scheduled to resume for Indiana's over 500,000 beneficiaries beginning next month. For WFHB, I'm Jake Jacobson.
The city of Bloomington began an extensive survey of municipal trees last week. The city has contracted with the Ohio-based Davy Resource Group to conduct the project. 5 teams of arborists will be counting and evaluating trees and their planting spaces until the end of April. Their survey will be conducted along the city's rights-of-way streets and parks. Nearly 18,000 publicly owned trees will be evaluated over the course of the spring assessment. The project's total cost is estimated to be around $125,000, amounting to approximately $7 per tree. The assessment also serves as part of the City of Bloomington's Bicentennial Trees and Trails Bond. The bond funds several infrastructure projects focusing on city amenities and public spaces in commemoration of Bloomington's 200th anniversary. The Bicentennial Trees and Trails Bond is a $10 million bond used to develop the City of Bloomington's Switchyard Park, extend the Beeline Trail to include an east-west corridor, and develop gateways at major entries to the city. The Davy Resource Group survey began last week and is expected to continue until the end of April.
This Thursday night, Bloomington Mayor John Hamilton will give his annual State of the City address. The first-term Democratic mayor's State of the City address will be given at the Buskirk Chumley Theater in downtown Bloomington. Mayor Hamilton announced earlier this year he'll stand for re-election in the mayoral race coming this summer. Hamilton will face fellow Democrat Monroe County Commissioner Amanda Barge in this May's primaries for Bloomington mayor. Barge is set to give a response to Hamilton's State of the City address on Friday morning. Last year's State of the City address was interrupted by Black Lives Matter protesters who disagreed with the city's nearly $250,000 purchase of an armored car for its police force. Hamilton is expected to discuss his administration's accomplishments particularly focusing on the areas of affordable housing, sustainability, and infrastructure. And WFHB will be live streaming the State of the City Address on Thursday, beginning at 7 p.m.
The Indiana House of Representatives passed a preliminary state budget out of committee this morning. House Bill 1001 largely falls in line with Indiana Governor Eric Holcomb's budget proposal put forward late last year. The 155-page budget proposal includes an estimated $36 billion in statewide funding over the next 2 years. House Bill 1001 would also eliminate the Office of State-Based Initiatives, an organization in the state's Office of Budget Management, which was established by Vice President Mike Pence's administration. The Office of State-Based Initiatives was meant to track federal grant reporting after state agencies received federal funding. Its governance falls under State Auditor Tara Klutz. The state budget also includes modest increases for state teachers, tracking with Governor Holcomb's call for an increase in statewide teacher pay to combat the state's teacher shortage. House Bill 1001 establishes a 2% increase to state education funding over the next 2 years. The budget bill also includes an increase to the income tax credit for teachers buying school supplies out of pocket. It would raise the $100 tax credit to $500. Among other considerations to the House's biennial budget proposal include the termination of State Police Department collection of handgun licensing fees as of July 1st. Those fees would be collected and added to the state's general fund as of 2021. House Bill 1001 passed out of the House Ways and Means Committee this morning. It will need to be passed in the House floor by Monday. Reporting live for WFHB, I'm Don Guerra.
And I'm Todd Wicks. The Daily Local News is brought to you by MPI Solar, a Bloomington business specializing in solar hot water, solar electricity, and solar hot air systems. MPI Solar designs and installs solar power generation systems that encourage independence and individual responsibility. Found locally at 812-334-4003 and on the web at mpisolarenergy.com.
The Richland Bean Blossom Community School Corporation School Board heard complaints and support from area residents last night. Community members spoke out in support of and against RBB School Superintendent Jerry Sanders' decision to mail out a letter to area churches asking them for their prayers and support, both to him personally and for the school district. WFHB Assistant News Director Sarah Vaughn brings us that report.
Ellettsville community members are still discussing a prayer request made by RBB CSC Superintendent Dr. Jerry Sanders in December. Sanders sent a letter to around 20 Ellettsville area churches asking them to pray for the students and staff of Richland Bean Blossom Community Schools. The newly hired superintendent asked specifically for prayers for the students' learning and development, as well as prayers for himself. Sanders' letter also stated, quote, "God will bless RBBSC with a strong partnership between school and home," unquote. He has since said the letter was meant to be a marketing tool. The RBB superintendent's letter drew criticism, with some saying it violated the principle of separating church and state. RBB School Board President Dana Carr issued a statement in response saying Sanders' letter was a personal request that should not have been sent on RBB letterhead. In his statement, Carr said, quote, "RBB CSC is a public school corporation and we are neutral with respect to religion," unquote. At last night's RBB school board meeting, police officer Todd Durnell applauded Sanders' actions. Durnell and his wife are Edgewood High School graduates and have two children currently in the RBB school system.
We've talked about how we're losing students to these faith-based schools. Well, if we want some of those kids back, I can tell you right now, and I brought the point up the other day to one of the school board members, that if I come into the community and I see that the superintendent has written a letter asking for prayer, I'm going to feel a lot more comfortable going to that school as a Christian.
Another resident, Karen Wilkie, said it may have been within Sanders' right to make a personal request for prayers, but it shouldn't have been made on the school system's letterhead. Wilkie's two children attend RBB schools.
That makes it sound like the entire school is requesting your prayers when that should have been a private, personal request. I did not ask for prayers. I was personally, if people want to pray for my children, fine. But not all families in the corporation feel that way. Not all families want religion in their home or certainly in their school. And so I would just hope that future policy includes that things like that are done on a personal level rather than on a corporation letterhead, making it look like it's coming from the school and from the school board.
Area resident John Samples said he stands behind the superintendent because most of the Eltsville community is Christian. Further, he said he doesn't see a problem with Superintendent Sanders using the RBB letterhead, which he said is paid for by taxpayers.
Why wouldn't you reach out to the Christian community if you're wanting to bring kids back from the charter schools that are faith-based? Why would you not? Would you slight them? Would you like to see some more bleeding from the schools with anti-Christian bigotry in a community that is Christian-based? Best way to do that is to keep beating the bandwagon that God's not welcome in the public square.
Area resident Carol Wilson said she is troubled by the idea Sanders' letter was meant to serve as a marketing tool.
This was not a letter that had anything to do with selling Richland Bean Blossom schools to parents to come here. You know, send their kids here. That's what marketing would be. You have all kinds of funds draining because of charter schools and vouchers and all of that. And if you want them, those children, to come back to the public school systems, you have to do marketing. I think it's crazy, but I understand it. But that's not the same letter that's going to go to the real estate companies.
Wilson asked Superintendent Sanders whether his letter went to other faith communities in the area.
We did a Google search of the churches in Richland and Bean Blossom townships, and those were the churches we sent the letters to.
Okay, but what about Jewish students?
We didn't send it to students, we sent it to churches.
I know, but
there aren't
any
Jewish churches.
So you don't want Jewish prayers for your students?
Certainly. If we had a synagogue,
We won't get it. That concerned me.
The discussion between Wilson and Sanders was shut down by school board president Dana Carr. Pamela Davison took issue with both the superintendent's letter and Carr's response to it. Davison is an attorney whose three children graduated from RBB schools. She addressed Sanders' letter first.
I understand that he did it with the best of intentions. It's still so grossly inappropriate, I can't say. I'm an attorney. The separation of church and state cannot be more clear. He said to me it was done for marketing. That's nonsensical to me, because the greatest competition for RBB schools is right down the street, Seven Oaks. The only thing I can think of is marketing, is saying to people, you can still send your kids to public school in Ellisville because we're still Christian-based.
Davison, who serves on the WFHB Board of Directors, said she has voiced her concerns to Dr. Sanders in a phone conversation.
Dr. Sanders was very lovely on the phone, but he doesn't get it. He never talked about his legal responsibility. He's never talked about separation of church and state. He never talked about it was inappropriate for me to do it. He does not get it. I say that very respectfully. You do not get that. So I'm very upset. I'm upset that kids are, that the bias is here, that it's completely okay, and that the school board and other people have done nothing to dissuade it. So I would like for you to respectfully look at that issue again.
Davison referred to the situation as a learning opportunity, which she feels the board is squandering. The board did not address any of the public comments during the meeting. Reporting for WFHB, I'm Sarah Vaughn.
Coming up next, the Bicentennial Journal, looking back on 200 years of history in South Central Indiana.
County's Bicentennial Committee presents the Bicentennial Journal, stories celebrating the rich history of Monroe County.
This is my Monroe County story. My name is Scott Ferris, and the story continues. So the legacy of the Ferris family is that we were one of the earliest settlers of Bloomington. We came here from South Carolina. We're Scotch-Irish, like a lot of folks, the earliest settlers of the community. My great-great-great-grandfather was a religious person. He was the first pastor, but he was also a farmer and an educator. And he did take and tutor students in mathematics at Indiana University. His kids went on to be ministers as well. Four of his kids graduated from Indiana University when it was a seminary back in the 1850s and 60s. So going back and talking about James Ferris when he first came to Bloomington, they lived up on Blair Farm, which is up on the west side. And if you study the history of Bloomington, that's one of those areas that's an historic landmark. He lived in a log cabin up there. And he was given an opportunity primarily because of the money that he was able to take and save as a principal in the Pendleton Academy down in South Carolina. He acquired 160 acres, and they were called school auctions back in the day. This was to raise money for the school system. And that 160 acres is where the IU Sports Complex is today. The Assembly Hall, the stadium, and the other sports-related facilities in that area. My great-great-great-grandfather, James Ferris, and then subsequent generations for almost 129 years, farmed that property, and we sold it to the university in the 1950s. The Herman B. Wells, when he was president of Indiana University, for those folks who remember the IU history, we were running out of space with the old field house, and there was no place to go, and that was premier land right next to the university. And for years, Herman B. Wells had eyes on it, and eventually the university went after that. James Ferris was a scholar. He was an educator, a farmer, a reformer, first pastor of the Reformed Presbyterian Church here in Bloomington, which is on First and Lincoln. It's still there today. And he was a mathematician. He tutored various folks at IU at the time. One in particular was Joseph Wright, who is Wright Quad, who became the governor and a U.S. senator down the road. The Ferris Farm, which faced Dunn, 17th Street, Fee Lane, and Matlock Road, which is the bypass. They grew all sorts of crops and cattle and milk cows and the like, and actually supplied milk to Johnson's Creamery back in the day and to Ferris Brothers Meat Market. Ferris Brothers Meat Market was my grandfather and two of his brothers, and they acquired the market from the, and these are some old Bloomington names. You had the Henkel family, and you had the Serre family, and this is about 1923. I do believe that members of my family worked in those businesses before they bought it. The Ferris Market didn't come into being until, I think, 1923. And my grandfather and his brothers had it for any number of years, and then my father came back from World War II, and this is Charles Bud Ferris. He took over the market and renamed it Ferris Market, and he stayed in that market until the day he died, literally. Some of you might remember him. He was in city politics for 25 years, and he was the first president of the City Council of Bloomington when it became a second-class city. In fact, the Ferris family has over five generations of IU graduates. We had the first female graduate in 1925, and that legacy was continued after a period of time when Ferris Market was created, and it was passed on to my father. And what we found is that Bloomington is a great community. If my kids and grandkids locate back to Bloomington, we'll actually have a seventh and eighth generation Ferris in the community. And that's about it. Appreciate the opportunity to talk about it.
Join us next week for another edition of the Monroe County Bicentennial Journal.
Support for the Bicentennial Journal and WFHB comes from Monroe County and Visit Bloomington. More information about Monroe County's bicentennial is available at monroecounty200.us.
You've been listening to the Daily Local News on WFHB. Today's headlines were written by Andrew McKieran, Jake Jacobson, and Wes Martin in partnership with CATS, Community Access Television Services. Our feature was produced by Sarah Vaughn.
The Bicentennial Journal is produced by Kate Welch with help from Jace Pauling. Our engineer is executive producer Wes Martin with help from Kevin Oliver. Our theme music is provided by Ben Lumsdane, Scott Schmedke, and Danny Graff. For WFHB, I'm Todd Wicks.
And I'm Don Guerra. Thanks for supporting Indiana's only volunteer-powered, listener-supported independent daily news program. You can hear tonight's full broadcast, as well as all other WFHB news programming online at wfhb.org.
You can be a part of our award-winning news team. For more information about joining our volunteer team of citizen journalists, email news@wfhb.org.
Stay tuned for Counterspin, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting's weekly radio show, providing a critical examination of national headlines. That's coming up next on WFHB.
You've been listening to the Daily Local News on WFHB Bloomington Community Radio. Our news is written and reported by volunteers working to provide local news, cover local issues, and strengthen our local community. We invite you to participate. You may submit questions, comments, and story ideas to news@wfhb.org. You can become a Daily Local News volunteer by attending new volunteer orientation. You can find an archive of past shows and individual news reports online at wfhb.org and catch live broadcast of the Daily Local News Monday through Thursday at 5 p.m. We are local, longer.